Education is very, very wonderful and very, very important. But what is even more so is the impetus within us. If we don't have something to say that's genuine and authentic, then all the education in the world is just going to turn out a little robot.
Welcome to Measure for Measure, new music, new thoughts. A series of conversations with movers and shakers and a few cage rattlers on the front lines of the new music universe. I'm Philip Blackburn from the American Composers Forum. We'll be talking about where old school ideas meet the new, searching backstage for handy hints that might give composers a leg up, what it means these days to compose a career, and trying to figure out the question of life, music, and everything. Please visit us online at composersforum.org/measureformeasure. And share your thoughts about today's show at composersforum.gather.com. Measure for Measure is supported by the National Endowment for the Arts, that believes that a great nation deserves great art. You haven't been involved much with academia on the teaching end?
No, I've been very fortunate to be asked occasionally to show up as a guest lecturer, and I love talking to students, and I do that from time to time, and in residencies and whatever. But no, I've never been employed by a university.
Congratulations.
they probably don't want me. I'd corrupt the students. Joy, joy, it's all about joy.
Yeah, well, they may not pay their tuition bills if they heard that.
That's right. They might just go off to Belize or something and have a good time.
We can't have that. So what's your view of your education and the education you wish you could pass on to others?
My view, I think education, if one can get it, is a marvelous tool. It's a marvelous tool. I had a phenomenal education because growing up in New York City, starting from the time I was 15, which is when I realized I was going to be a composer. I mean, I started writing when I was 9, and so I knew very early on that this was the path I was going to take. And growing up in New York City, you've got, well, I did my first summer at Manus College of Music, and then I did Juilliard pre-college, and then I had Manhattan School of Music, and then during the summers I went off to the Aspen Music Festival. I had the most amazing, and then on top of that I had private lessons for years with a fantastic pianist, a recitalist in town, private lessons. And I had an extraordinary musical education, due in large part because I had extraordinary parents who valued education. And I was a very nerdy kid who would always ask for lessons, and they were very, thank goodness, they were very generous and willing to give them to me because they saw that I was making use of them and I was practicing and writing, and you know, it wasn't like the kid where you pay for the piano lessons and they don't practice. So I was very, very, very fortunate. So I always value that education, and I think even though now more than ever there are so many paths to take outside of academia and outside of education, to have those tools, to have the craft, to have mentors to show you the right way of, not right way in terms of right and wrong, but to show you the way of progressing in life and ways of doing things, it's invaluable. And I always encourage education for those who can get it. Now, at the same time, I don't believe one has to be a literate musician to write wonderful music. I'm not one of those people. In Hollywood, as a matter of fact, there's a term we use about people who don't necessarily read and write music that well. We call them hummers, right? That's the kind of a derogatory term, but I think it's great. I mean, if you have good musical instincts and if you have good ideas, yes, it behooves you, it makes your life easier to be literate, and I'm very literate as a musician, so I would wish that on everybody. But does it mean that you're a lesser composer or not as able a tunesmith or not as able to break someone's heart musically if you can't do those things? No, because the education is very, very wonderful and very, very important. But what is even more so is the impetus within us. If we don't have something to say that's genuine and authentic, then all the education in the world is just going to turn out a little robot. It's not going to turn out anything that we're all going to want to tune into. You have to have the first thing, the inner heart, before the education is going to make you a great composer. That being said, if you have the inner heart, if you have the impetus, yeah, the education can give you so many more tools and ways of expressing yourself, and I find getting yourself out of a jam when you're writing something and you're stuck and you have to think, okay, there's usually a moment in a piece when you're writing where you have been on the flow, you've been in the groove, and then suddenly something in the universe just put the brakes on. And it really helps be able to think a little bit about craft. Like, how can I take the material I just wrote and turn it on its ear a little bit? What can I do with this? What can I do with that motive? How can I look at that rhythm a little differently? You know, just to get you kind of over a hump very creatively. And these are wonderful tools. And these are kind of tricks that are learned over time. Education's a good thing. I wish, the one thing about education for young kids, starting nursery school, kindergarten, up through elementary school, that is we're going to pay deeply for in the future, is that if we don't put instruments in the hands of kids, and if we don't connect them to the joy of making music, or making any kind of art for that matter, who the hell do we expect to be buying concert tickets and caring about what we do 20 years from now? That is my biggest concern, is that so many people I know who love and appreciate music of any kind have had some kind of personal experience with it when they were growing up, and certainly people our age all did. You know, we were lucky. We grew up, most of us, at a time when there was some kind of music and art education in our schools as kids. But now I look at the double whammy that some of these kids are getting, where not only are they not getting music and art in their schools, but when they come home, their parents are not interested in it either, for whatever reason. So they're not getting a house filled with music and art. They're not getting it from any place. And so they're so separate from it. It doesn't mean that when they're 23 or 33 or 43, they can't suddenly be turned on to it. I'm sure many of them will be. But I just think it's less likely to happen that they're going to have that automatic connection, as if we were to embrace them with these wonderful things as they're growing up and make it part of their consciousness.
I certainly think it's true that the less we participate in something, the less we understand or care about it. Yeah. You've certainly known that about sports.
Absolutely. Yeah, I feel that way about sports. You know, I wasn't a big sports person growing up, but I can relate better to basketball and baseball than I can to football, because, hey, I got to play some basketball and baseball growing up, and I know what it felt like to either catch or, in my case, mostly miss the ball versus football, which, you know, I never could connect with, never understood it, never got to play it, whereas typically a lot of guys do, and they connect with it more. Which isn't to say a lot of women don't like football, but my own personal experience is that I don't understand it because I never got to do it.
So, yeah, I think you're right that Western art music is going to have a problem in the next few generations, mm-hmm. because, you know, those skills are in an ever more rarefied atmosphere the way that they're being passed mm-hmm. on. But I think two things will happen to the remainder of the populace. They'll become really excellent consumers, great at video games and shopping channels and being robots. And, you know, I've been noticing more and more recently, if you see employees in stores, they are the perfect robot. Whether they're flight attendants or they're trying to give you a presentation, mm-hmm. you can see the script that they've had to memorize in order to communicate with you. Is this really the pinnacle of human endeavor, or is it just what corporations need to have? And the other thing that I think will happen is there'll be new musical formats that people can easily participate in, that they can share and learn with their friend. Mm-hmm. They are the audience for each other. I'm thinking of like the
Garage Band is a good
garage
example.
Bands, the noise underground scene mm-hmm. in LA, for instance, where, you know, anyone can take a guitar and get some feedback, mm-hmm. turn up really, really loud. But some are better at it than others.
Right.
And they've maybe been blessed with a greater gift and a talent from birth, or maybe they've just paid more attention. They're more capable of listening in the moment, mm-hmm. of improvising. Yeah. Those are musical skills too.
Absolutely.
I think it's an uphill struggle for yeah. some, and it's a new vista for others.
But, you know, you do mention it being more in the hands of more people, and that's really significant, at least. I mean, I'm not saying this counters or takes the place of music education in the schools. It doesn't. But at least things like Apple's GarageBand, which a lot of people are familiar with, making pseudo-composing tools, or as I like to call them, compilation tools, at least, available to a lot of people, people with a computer. I think this is wonderful. Again, it gives them some way of connecting with music and with music making, and it turns out, in some cases, a pretty cool sounding amateur effort. It can be nice. I think, again, if it makes somebody smile, that it's a good thing. I think one of the problems in music and art is it spends way too much time judging, and deciding whether something is high art or crap or amateur or professional. And I think we need to back off from that and let things that are clearly good in reaching people reach people on their own merit and stop worrying so much about whether they have merit or whether they are worthy or not. If we can open up more of what we're doing, and back to the joy thing of connecting, of just making music in this case, with everybody, I think that's good for all of us, to connect everybody with it. This is not an elitist art form, and elitism has, and in some cases an academic approach to it, has been the death of what we're doing. And it risks being even more so if we don't change these rigid, silly, elite ways that we have traditionally viewed, you know, concert music and other things that are not rock and roll. We've got to get out of that. And I have written somewhat extensively online about these subjects because I care about them a lot, because I think if we don't change our thinking, it's a done deal. No one's going to care.
I think we're kind of in the dying days of the last throes and the last gasps of the masterpiece culture, the greatness culture, because we see, as academically trained composers, that we are in the lineage of the great masters. Mm-hmm. And we've got a whole theoretical framework that proves and analyzes on paper exactly why they were so great. At the time, they were just improvisers at the keyboard who notated stuff and played some games as they went along, and maybe no better or worse than some of our composers and artists today. But there were few enough of them, and they're the ones whose archives persisted throughout history, and the performing resources were geared towards playing more or less that kind of music, which evolved in a more or less linear fashion. Now, in the 21st century, we don't have those gatekeepers anymore. We don't have the dukes and duchesses, the queens, the governments, the kind of support network that isolates one or two people or one or two pieces as the pinnacle, and everyone else shouldn't really be trying. So the whole elitism thing. And yet, in order to sift through this mass of information that's out there and try and find meaning, there are people in whose interest it is to elevate some and demonize others. Mm-hmm. So yeah, you can't even enjoy a piece without feeling guilty for enjoying it, if it's a really silly piece. I mean, occasionally you can find one that's, oh yeah, that's a really cool piece and I enjoyed it. Mm-hmm. But more often, if you find something you enjoy, you say, well, I know it's naff.
But I think that can be true in the pop world too, by the way. I think record companies in the pop world can make or break whoever they choose to make or break too, and it can be for political or random reasons that don't have to do with other things. I mean, I think that what you're saying is a problem across the board in lots of areas outside of music and also within all genres of music. Maybe that's an unavoidable aspect of being human, of our human species. We are a terribly imperfect species, and we're not always so nice. And, well, you and I are, of course, lovely, but everybody else.
People know that.
I wonder if that's just, you know, just human nature, is that it does that.
It's also a problem of a complete misconception. People think music is a thing, not an activity.
Right.
As soon as you think it's a thing, you can judge it, you can sell it, you can reproduce it. Mm-hmm. Is like everything else in one sense. But when you say, I can whistle a tune that I don't remember ever hearing before, that makes me happy. Does that make me a composer? Oh, what a loaded word that is.
Yeah.
Can I get a grant for it, even though I didn't write it down? And all this kind of monkey mind comes into play, saying, well, you know, I'm here, but my idea of what a composer is and does and should be and the history of music and all that heavy weight of Eurocentric thinking, that causes real problems. And yet if we didn't have that, we wouldn't have this thing we have as the music industry
that's right.
Provides our livelihood.
Exactly. All composing is, by the way, is improvising in slow motion. I mean, I've always thought that the snobbiness against, and again, we're back to elitism, I suppose, but against improvisers and just putting them off in a side category is so unwarranted and so unfair and so not listening. It's just a dumb approach, and it makes me very sad that improvising composers, as I like to call them, and improvising artists, improvising instrumentalists have had to deal with that for so long. Because I mean, I should be so lucky as to be able to, you know, pick up an instrument and improvise the way these great artists do. I should be so lucky. I'm the slow motion person who has to sit there for hours or days or weeks and write it down note for note. You know, the end result might be the same, but it takes me many, many more times as long. to do it. So
yeah, it's a matter of the medium kind of fixing that moment in history, or in this case, a few weeks slice of history is what's encapsulated in that piece.
And fixing it is recording. I mean, that's what this is. The other thing is, who cares about notation? And this is certainly true in electronic music, is a great example on both sides of that fence. Who cares about notation if the end result is for recording, if you're not trying to get other people necessarily to play it, or if they're going to play it after the fact and do takedowns, as we call it, you know, off of the record. But it's, you know, I do about a third of what I do now is electroacoustic music, and I'm not notating in a traditional way. You know, there's amorphous, woozy, you know, electronic tracks. There's no way to notate them. So notation is something that Beethoven and others had to do to get their music played by others. It's less and less the case now.
Right. If you want your music played by others, then you'll find whatever level of notation is needed to convey that. And where does the music reside? Is it in the score or in the act of listening?
Right.
So we get into the whole kind of, if it's something fixed in the traditional compositional way of thinking of a score, whether it's fixed on paper or fixed on tape, they're both scores. Mm-hmm. That can generate any number of performances.
Absolutely.
The piece is never exhausted, because every time you press the play button,
it's new.
It's new, it's in a different context, your life is different, the audience is different. Mm-hmm. So if the score is the thing that apparently fixes it, this also kind of puts the focus away from the act of listening. We've got a large number of pieces in the world. We don't know how many pieces are left that haven't been written. Is it finite or is it infinite? And I was thinking a moment ago that you were saying, you know, composition, improvisation are related in terms of how they're fixed. And Mary Catherine Bateson, daughter of Margaret Mead, wrote a book called Composing a Life.
One of my favorite books.
Mine too. Yes. Which is more improvising a life than composing
Absolutely.
A life. But we're all doing it.
Yep.
So none of what we're talking about is even related solely to acoustics or music or language in that sense. You see a situation, it's full of possibilities. You take one path over another, you adapt.
Exactly.
Hey, it's evolution as well. So this whole kind of expanded notion of what it is to be a composer, I think first of all has to be deconstructed.
Yes.
If we're human, we're doing it.
Right.
If you're able to hear this, then you're probably doing it as well. And right now you're trying to make sense of what we're putting out there as
That's
well.
Right.
Whenever you're making sense and coming to know something, the way you've put that together historically in your psyche and your whole history of habits and the language that we're speaking in, all suggest what you're going to get out of it. So talking about the supply and demand, talking about the production and the reception of music, it's one thing to sit in a concert hall knowing that you've heard a piece 100 times before and you're just longing for that melody to come back, but you don't really like the bridge passages, i.e. something very familiar. It's another thing to pay money to go to hear a piece of new music that you know you've never heard before. You're not even convinced whether the players are enjoying it or not, but they've got to go through it because it's before intermission and you can't leave yet. And believing that you have to understand the new music rather than experience it.
Mm.
I don't know if people go to modern art galleries knowing or thinking that they have to understand a piece by Warhol or Rauschenberg or something.
Right.
No, because they automatically come up with a response. Some of it's trivializing, derogatory, some of it's, but all of it's spot on in some sense.
Mm-hmm.
All of it's a response to the experience.
Right.
It's so hard for us to talk about the experience, because we don't really have a lot of training in experiencing. We're not trained for listening.
Yeah.
So I think that's one of the areas that educational can work on.
Oh, I agree.
Yeah.
I agree.
And indeed, all of the forces in society are telling us that that's not even necessary. You can buy an electronic keyboard. It's already got buttons and a manual on page one saying, press this button.
That's right.
And it will sound like music within seconds. Because if it doesn't, we failed. We'll get our Japanese programmers on that problem right away. We want you to have some looping, some 4/4 and 120 beats per minute. We want you to hear some tonal harmonies, maybe some parallel ones if you play the left finger. And we live in this Walmart world of, you know, I know what music is and I want an easy way of getting to
it. That's right, instant gratification.
Yeah.
And it's just, boom, here it is. Yep.
Do you think the coin is going to flip at some point where music is so available that, you know, we just don't need any more of it?
No, I don't think that coin's going to flip. It seems to be such a inherent and inextricable part of being human Since the time we were on this planet, we were banging on things and singing. We have just always done these things. I think we are going to have to become extinct from this planet before music stops being made and music stops being cared about. I think we're no different now, other than the mass consumption of it and the many, many more different styles of it available to most of us, than we were, you know, hundreds of years ago. Everything is changing and adapting and evolving. Styles are changing. I would imagine people were having this conversation a couple hundred years ago. Oh my God, you know, they say, have you seen that new composer and what he's doing? And, you know, the world is falling apart. The sky is crumbling and nobody's going to want music after this and it's just ruining it for everybody. And clearly that didn't happen. So, and as you pointed out in the beginning of our conversation, more people than ever now are composers. So I have great hope, not so much for the ongoing nature of our species. I'm convinced that we're going to just do ourselves in fairly shortly, within a few generations. I'm not convinced we're all going to be here on the planet, because I feel like we're a scourge. But other than that, on a more cheery note, I think that as long as we are here, we're going to be making art. And it is going to keep changing. And technology is going to affect the delivery of that. It's going to affect the way people experience it. Some of that is not going to be to our liking, because all of us who've been here on the planet for a few decades get pissed off that things aren't the same way that they used to be. That's a natural part of being a human, especially as one gets into middle age and beyond. I have complained before about the whole concept of, well, nobody really listens to an album as a concept anymore, the way it used to be back in the 60s. You'd buy an LP and you'd have to flip the sides to, you know, a physical act just to hear the other half of it. But you'd listen usually, because it was kind of a hassle to just lift the needle and go track to track. And half the listeners to this podcast have no idea even what I'm talking about. What, needle track? What's that? Now we can just choose, instead of experiencing somebody's entire offering of 50 minutes or 70 minutes that they've slaved over for X number of years, however long it took them to put it together, now they can just say, oh, I just want that one tune. But what they don't get is that the artist envisioned all these tunes together, or if it's tunes, if it's pop, or all these movements together. I mean, I've got multi-movement pieces where people can, and I'm sure they do, just download one of the movements. Hey, why not? I'm happy. I just want people to hear this stuff. But it's not how I envisioned the piece. Obviously, I wrote it with three movements in mind, or five movements or whatever, and someone's going to just choose one or two. Hey, modular music. We have no control over that, ultimately. And, things shift and change. We have to be flexible and change with them. If we don't, you know, adapt or die, right? We have to do it.
We started with joy, and that sounds like a cheery note.
Adapt or die. Feel the joy.
Watch this space.
It is about joy. We have to always stay focused on the joy wherever we can find it, and wherever we can make it, and wherever we can encourage it from other people around us. That's, in fact, the most important thing, is having it reflect back to us from other people that we can hopefully encourage it from.
And there's why I live in you. Thank you, Alex.
Thank you, Philip.